In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Monday, September 12, 2011 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I am glad to hear that we are all here together today without any issues having happened yesterday and with some wonderful observances. And thank you for the kind feedback that we've gotten on our continuing coverage of 9/11, A Government Changed. And you can find all of those resources at federalnewsradio.com. My guest in the 3 o'clock hour today is somewhat tied to this, the events of 10 years ago yesterday. He is Ronald Newman, and he is author of the book The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan, and he's been intimately associated with that country for 40 or 50 years now, sir.
One way and another.
That's right. Ambassador Newman was the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, and we'll talk about that period of service. But as I learned very well from your book, your father was also the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan at a different time and almost a different country, I guess, than what you experienced when you were there. Some of your reminiscences of what you saw as you went to the embassy and how it compared to your memories of being there when you lived there and when your father served were my favorite parts of the book, because I'm a sucker for a story like that when I think about a baseball player whose father played in the big leagues, or there was a NASCAR driver not too long ago I saw do an interview about winning a race at a track that he attended races at as a child. So those kinds of juxtapositions I find tremendously fascinating, and I have some information about your book posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. So folks can learn about it. I'm grateful to have you here again today. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. Yes, I visited Afghanistan first in 1967, just out of graduate school. I had 3.5 months before I had to show up for the Army, where I'd rashly volunteered. And so my wife and I went out and spent that time in Afghanistan. And being old enough to travel and unemployed enough to be free to do so, we got around all over the country. We drove from one side to the other through the center dirt roads with one Afghan engineer and an American aid fellow. And I even went up on a hunting party into the far northeast, where we went to the end of the road by four-wheel drive and then by horse along the Amudara, the Oxus River, and then switched to yaks and went up into the high hunting ground in the Pamirs.
It's really amazing stuff, and you write about those some of those things in the book, and we'll talk more about that throughout the course of the show. I want to start out, though, by talking about where we are, in your view, in the Foreign Service today. We have spent, not just our radio station, but those of us who talk about what goes on in the federal government, have spent a lot of time talking about what may or may not happen to the Department of Defense, in given the budget situation that we're in and the super committee about to meet and so on and so forth. Not as much attention has been paid, nearly as much, to the State Department and to USAID in particular. And yet Secretary Gates, not very long before he left office, was talking very explicitly about soft power and the need for more resources at state. And it's not just money, it's people, too. So I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about what you see as kind of the state of Foreign Service today, both the people individually who are in there, their views of the world and how they see themselves fitting into the efforts that the United States is making around the world, and then as a collective, just the overall health of the Foreign Service.
Big subject, one we've given quite a bit of study to in my day job at the American Academy of Diplomacy, where we've done some major studies in the last couple of years, both on how many people we felt were needed in state and aid, and we basically concluded in 2008 that we had hollow organizations that were incapable of fully discharging their functions for any administration, for any policy. And then we've done some fairly rigorous study of professional education and training, because one of the things we find with the Foreign Service today is that between having not had enough people, having retirements now, and adding people at the bottom, we have a big mid-career gap. That is, we have two-thirds of Foreign Service officers right now have less than 10 years in the Foreign Service. That really tells you that you need to spend a lot of attention on supervisory training, mid-level training. You can't do just mentoring under the old guard the way we used to. That was always our excuse for training that we didn't do. when two-thirds of your officers have less than 10 years experience, you don't have enough of a mid-level to just train by on-the-job learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the big debilities of where we're going in the budget. Now, under Secretary Clinton, and frankly the last budget in the Bush administration, there has been some rebuilding of personnel. What that has done is it's filled the most critical gaps, but it provides no reserve for training. People who are familiar with the military know that the military is staffed at about 15% over all the jobs in all the units. That's the training and transition float. And that's what allows them to maintain training, not only of units, but training of individuals and mid-career training, why Dave Petraeus has a PhD. The State Department does not have a comparable reserve.
Mm-hmm.
It has to train by pulling people out of jobs. And the result is it does less and less training. It's done a lot more over the years, but it's still grossly inadequate to the needs of a professional service.
You talk about the fact that there is no reserve and no float. The challenge there is, I suppose, not just finding the money to pay people to do it, but also finding the people with the skills who are appropriate to do that kind of work. I imagine these kinds of positions are not just the kinds of jobs where you can take a generic college graduate, plug them in, and expect them to be able to do the job in a short period of time.
That's true. You know, the Foreign Service confronts the issue that it still has to have all the skills that it always had, because none of what you might call the old diplomacy has gone away, but it has a phenomenal number of new skills and challenges. It is interesting that in repeated surveys of military officers who have served with state officers in provincial reconstruction teams and things like that in Iraq and Afghanistan, you find that the skills they most valued were political knowledge and cultural experience. So clearly these bedrock skills are still needed.
Mm-hmm.
But we confront a very different world in the 21st century, from multinational organizations to non-governmental organizations to non-state actors. And so you need a broad variety of knowledge, but you need the ability to plug that knowledge into foreign cultures. It isn't just technical skills. That's a kind of a hole that's not really examined when people talk about whole of government. They talk about it as though if you have a skill in justice or commerce or energy, you can just take that peg out of the hole in the U.S. and plug it in the hole overseas. And my experience watching this work in Iraq and then Afghanistan is that we waste a lot of money sending technically very qualified people who have no idea how to get their ideas accepted mm-hmm. in foreign cultures. That remains one of our key jobs in the Foreign Service and in USAID.
You talk about cultural experience, and I wonder if the model, the way I understand it, where an officer serves a period of time at one post and then moves to another and moves to another, is that model maybe due for not a change, but maybe a refurbishment where we have folks who are specialists in at least a particular part of the world? Like most of your service has been in the Middle East and South Asia, and that's a region of the world that there are some fairly significant cultural similarities, at least from country to country.
No question. And we do maintain that. That is there now in the model. What you find is that political officers, public diplomacy officers, to some extent economic officers, tend to be very specialized in one or two regions of the world. Administrative and consular officers, somewhat less so because their jobs are more similar from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
But that level of specialization exists. Where I do think we need more focus is on longer tours in some of the hardest areas. Admittedly, these are areas where it's hard to serve. We've got something like 18% of our posts overseas are now considered too dangerous to bring your family mm-hmm. with you. And this is generally not known, I think, outside the Foreign Service. But often those are the posts, especially places like Afghanistan, where you really need to build very specialized knowledge as well as the general knowledge. You can't have everybody serve a long time, but it's hugely necessary that we have longer tours for our most senior people.
Ambassador Ronald Newman's my guest on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, talking about building or rebuilding the Foreign Service, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Federal Broadband Minute, provided by Hughes.
If your agency's communications network was tailored to your needs, what would it look like? Would your small and medium-sized field offices connect to the cloud and run applications with optimal bandwidth efficiency? Would your ideal network be cost-effective and able to leverage the benefits of GSA programs? Would it provide path-diverse communications that support COOP for the same price as your primary network service? And with your network, would you have confidence in secure connectivity, especially for teleworkers? Say yes to all these questions and meet the Government Field Office of the Future today from Hughes. With decades of experience and a comprehensive suite of solutions and partners, Hughes is able to deliver agencies a powerful national managed broadband service, providing voice, video, and data where, when, and how you need it.
To learn more, visit government.hughes.com/WFED.
What is the U.S. Department of Agriculture doing to transform rural America and enhance its prosperity? What is the USDA doing to cut costs and improve organizational performance? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with his very special guest, Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
For more than 80 years, Motorola has been committed to keeping Americans safe. Today, Motorola Solutions provides interoperable communication systems that are built to open standards so federal, state, and local agencies can work together in emergency situations and be their best in the moments that matter. That's why first responders and others dedicated to keeping citizens safe choose Motorola Solutions, because they know Motorola Solutions always puts public safety first, just like they do. To learn more, visit MotorolaSolutions.com/80.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Tuesday morning's Federal Drive. The deadline for BRAC is days away. We'll talk with one group that's already settled in, met the deadline, and battled tornadoes along the way. And we'll have an exit interview with NASA's chief technologist. What's the next step for NASA now? That and more Tuesday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For all the latest federal news, check us out on federalnewsradio.com.
Tired of playing catch-up with the news? Stay informed all the time with the Federal News Flash. The Federal News Flash is a daily email from Federal News Radio that will bring you the latest news and information about the federal government and the federal contracting world. Find out about exclusive stories and interviews only heard on Federal News Radio. Sign up for the Federal News Flash at federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Ambassador Ronald Newman's my guest. His book is called The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. And we talked a little bit during the break, sir, about the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the experiences that you had as the ambassador to Afghanistan after, what years were you there specifically?
2005 to 2007.
So you experienced the situation there at some of the roughest times and were there when some of the challenges that both the military, state AID, and the contracting community there were dealing with when they were trying to rebuild parts of the country. One of the major things that the commission talked about, and two of the commissioners were with me a couple of weeks ago, was the idea that there shouldn't be a cigar and a cigar, as the cigar obviously in Afghanistan, the mm-hmm. cigar in Iraq, another place that you served, that there should be a special inspector general as a standing position so that you don't need to go out and recruit somebody to oversee operations in an inspector general's capacity when a contingency happens. Your thoughts about that and your thoughts about the situation that you saw on the ground when you were in Afghanistan as regards contracting?
First, I think it makes sense to have a permanent position. Secondly, I think we need a more explicit recognition in crisis situations that we often have a tension between speed and oversight. And they both have values, but they often pull against each other, especially if when you go into a place like Afghanistan, particularly in the early days, when you have not had time to plan. You can't just tell people, stay miserable, we'll be back in 2 or 3 years after we've thought about this. But if you plunge in as you have to, then you're probably going to make mistakes. We need to have a way of recognizing our mistakes and fixing them without necessarily being crucified for it. At the same time, there are times when we need to decide, are we going to move quicker or are we going to move more carefully? If we're going to move quicker, then what are the standards that we're going to use instead of just money out the door or not having projects fail? I'll give you a specific example. We're still trying to do more projects using more Afghan contractors. Many of them do not have all the experience that American contractors have. At the same time, we know that in the U.S., small startups tend to have a very high failure rate, somewhere between a third and a half over a period of 2 years. So if we want really careful business plans, answers to all the questions to try to avoid failures, you're going to have a very heavy bureaucratic process with a lot of paper. That's also going to cause a lot of trouble for new Afghan businesses that don't have any experience doing this.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not going to do that, you're going to have a higher rate of failure, but then you're going to have other standards. You can't just say, well, a lot of people fail, so we accepted that. So you're going to have to think through what are your other standards, and you're going to have to educate the Congress on those standards before you start. Otherwise, you'll simply be pilloried for making excuses after you fail.
Mm-hmm.
So I think having a permanent IG makes sense. Having different standards and metrics that are a little more situationally acute would make sense also. It would also make sense to relieve us of some of our overwhelming federal standards that aren't suitable for wartime. You know, AID has to bid every contract for American firms. What that does is it creates a situation where they have to do very large sort of umbrella contracts, and then all the real contracts are the subcontracts under that as they go forward. Well, now you've guaranteed a whole second level of expensive foreign management because we don't have the personnel or the bureaucratic regulation for aid to do its own small contracting.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to fix that, you're going to have to give AID the people it needs to actually supervise and the legal flexibility to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes back to budgets in Congress. But you could save an awful lot if you had a structure that was capable of doing its own work, as you had in the past, rather than a structure that's only capable of writing contracts and checks.
If we had that structure in the past, where did it go away, and why did it go away?
It went away over a rather long period, partly in the misassumption that we could have a peace dividend after the end of the Cold War. Just to give you a couple of comparative statistics, when I first visited Afghanistan in 1967, the USAID was 10 times larger than it is today. We had more aid officers in Vietnam than we have in the world today. In the last 10 years, we have raised the money we're putting into foreign aid considerably while we've declined the staff, so that we actually have fewer officers responsible for more dollars, which is pretty close to being a recipe for poor oversight.
You mentioned that there should be some flexibility in the standards from theater to theater. Is it practical, though, to write several broad sets of guidelines ahead of time and be able to say in a particular contingency, well, this looks very similar to choice B, and so we'll modify choice B and be able to roll out? Or are these contingencies so unique that that's not really practical?
You know, I think you could write a set of guidelines for crisis situations, and you have that already in the two special purpose organizations within AID, one that does disaster relief and one that does so-called stabilization. It's called the Office of Transition Initiatives. They're both set up to work faster and smarter, but they're also very small organizations. As soon as you move into anything that's called development, you don't have these flexibilities.
My guest is Ronald Newman. He is a former ambassador to Afghanistan. He's now the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and he is author of the book, The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. We'll continue our conversation about building and rebuilding the Foreign Service when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life. Yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
No one said this in a while, so here it is. A reminder. This is America. America. In America, we do great things. We dream dreams and then conceive and create and educate and just plain work until they come true. Our greatness is not past. Are you kidding? It is here and now, just as it's always been and will always be. This is a message from Force 3. We design and implement security solutions that protect the nation's sensitive data. We create borderless networks and limitless communications. We're one of the thousands of American companies that are dreaming and growing and winning. If you're interested in today's most advanced technology solutions, or if you just want to meet people who are doing great things, visit Force3.com. Force 3. Let's do something great. Force 3 is a leading provider of EMC solutions to the federal government. Find out how Force 3 and EMC can deliver the right solution for your agency by visiting Force3.com.
What Facebook has done, they're transforming advertising. With Google click-through, you don't really know who's clicking through. But with Facebook, you can so specify who's looking at your ads that it's extremely targeted. That's why Google is so worried, because Facebook has created this closed ecosystem. They don't allow Google search into their little private kingdom. And Google is afraid that the Facebook community will become larger than Google's.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
No easy choice. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, screening for prostate cancer means searching for it early, before symptoms develop, when treatment, if it's needed, could be most effective. But prostate cancer screening has some asterisks. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Susan Laird notes that one screening tool involves measuring levels of prostate-specific antigen, or PSA, in the blood. The problem is that while PSA is higher with prostate cancer, it also can be higher due to other health problems, such as inflammation, obesity, and benign prostate disease. So Laird says the reading does not give easy answers.
To decide whether prostate cancer screening is right for you, discuss the pros and cons with your healthcare provider and the people important in your life.
Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Government IT executives, step into the past to start shaping the future. At this year's Executive Leadership Conference in Colonial Williamsburg, the American Council for Technology and the Industry Advisory Council's ELC Conference, October 23rd through the 25th, brings together government and industry leaders to address the acquisition, security, and human capital challenges you face in your increasingly mobile world. Register today at actgov.org. That's www.actgov.org.
The Federal Drive has a new sound. Tom Temin is joined by Amy Morris weekday mornings from 6 to 10. Tom and Amy cover the activities important to federal managers: HR, program management, budgeting, acquisition. The Federal Drive delivers fast-moving, crisp, insightful interviews good for busy feds dealing with political change. The Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Amy Morris on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Ambassador Ronald Newman is my guest. He's the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and his book about Afghanistan is called The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. The cover of the book has several ladies holding flowers. Are these poppies that these ladies are holding?
Actually, they're plastic. every time I would visit, and I traveled probably once a week most of the time when I was in Afghanistan, you would have, when I went to governor's office anyway, or provincial office, you'd often have a few small girls in Afghan traditional clothes holding flowers, often plastic, singing a song. It's a traditional welcome, which they do for all kinds of people, not just for the American ambassador. But the girls are very genuine, even if the flowers are plastic.
That's one of the things I love about talking to people, because stories like that I find just fascinating. We have information about this book linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We talked before we went on the air, too, that this is not just a book about this is my experience and this is my remembrance and so on. This is a real story. I mean, there's a story that you're telling in this. Did you write it that way on purpose?
Yes. I mean, I spent about a year and a half when my wife was telling me I ought to write this book before I got around to it, so I had a chance to think about why I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to explain to people something about what it is all the civilians are doing. You get a lot of stories about the military. Very few people have any understanding of what diplomacy, aid, justice work means in a place like Afghanistan. They hear the words, they don't understand the context.
Mm-hmm.
The context is complicated, and therefore, if you don't tell a story, I think you just lose people. You drown them in details.
The context of the entire situation in Afghanistan from the 80s onward, I think, has kind of gone by the wayside, because it's a complex country. It's a complex part of the world. It has a very complex history. And so for just any one person to be able to understand it all, to then try to explain it to somebody else, to distill that into something that the average person can understand is tremendously difficult. But context is really critical, don't you think, when it comes to understanding how things are working, especially in this country?
Oh, absolutely. I remember we had a debate when we were getting ready for the first parliamentary elections in 2005. And we had criteria, the UN was running the effort, about candidates being disallowed if they still had a militia or if they had certain kinds of crimes. Crimes was a harder one because there was no functioning justice system, so you actually had very little evidence. You had lots of allegations.
Mm-hmm.
But you got into very much contextual situations. I remember in one case, there was a pretty good reason to disbar a candidate. And on the other hand, if he were disbarred, his rather large tribe would have no candidate running in that province. And the reaction of the tribe would certainly not be, well, we broke the rules and got caught. It would be, this is a political action to disenfranchise the tribe.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, you make your best call on those kind of gray situations. But they're not easy calls. They're not clear right or wrong. Sometimes probably there are I'm sure there is clear right and wrong. But a lot of times you have to make decisions in the midst of a gray situation and make the best call you can.
And in a delicate situation like that, it's not just a matter of calling in that potential candidate or a representative of that tribe and saying, hey, listen, we're talking about trying to figure out a way to work this out. It's not nearly that simple, I wouldn't think.
No, it isn't. And another piece of the context in Afghanistan is that for years, especially the 25 years of civil war, Soviet occupation, the rest, Afghans have seen rules simply as things, tools that the powerful use to manipulate to do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing of the sort of Anglo-Saxon culture of rules are things we're all obeying or that we're supposed to obey and that if you get caught, you're in the wrong. There's much more of a sense that these things really don't matter. They're simply tools that the powerful use to subjugate the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So when you try to enforce our view of a rule-based culture, you frequently run into massive misinterpretations. And you can work your way through some of those, but you have to understand, first of all, that that's the context you're in.
Yeah, you have to know what you're up against, and that goes back to what you were talking about before, about the cultural experience that's so valuable, especially to members of the military that are going into those environments.
It is hugely valuable, and frequently, it's learned only by stubbing your toe on things,
mm-hmm.
Because so often the problems are not in the middle of the problem set. There was a study written of some of the problems we had in the East at one point. There was one case where the military was given land for a forward operating base by a tribe. The only trouble was the tribe gave them land belonged to another tribe, which produced then attacks on the base, counterattacks, people joining the insurgency. It took a certain amount of knowledge to sort out what was at the base of this, which had nothing to do with insurgency. It had to do with one tribe trying to manipulate power relationships with another one.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of knowledge is dearly paid for, and it's kind of like having your radar rotating all the time. You're looking for what the problem is coming in from another azimuth.
The lesson that I learned about context was there were headlines in the paper a couple of years back, to the effect of, I'm paraphrasing, the United States pays $450 a gallon for gasoline in Afghanistan. And when you drill down, you find, and I actually had it confirmed later for me by an official from the Army, you drill down and you find that not every single gallon of gas that is or of fuel that's used in Afghanistan costs $450. Turns out it does cost a lot of money to get fuel to some of the most remote parts of the country where access is extremely difficult and in many cases only by air. And so when you think, well, we're a couple hundred or so miles from any kind of main air access or land access, and there are people shooting at the aircraft that are trying to bring the fuel in, maybe it's a little bit more expensive than just pulling up at the gas station here in Washington and pumping fuel into the car. That's where that's an example of the idea of context and what it means in these kinds of situations, how that first occurred to me. Why is it difficult for people to think about those kinds of things until they're reminded of them like I was?
Well, they ruin a good story by being complicated. You know, it's always easier to have a good story if it's black and white, and it sells better if it provokes outrage.
Mm-hmm.
If it's hard to explain, it's harder to write a story that people want to read. And sometimes context is very complicated. We had an issue with the power project that I helped support and cobble. And one of the issues when we signed the contract was that the Afghan government promised that it would collect the charges from consumers so that it would have the money to buy the fuel for the generators for the next iteration. Now, the Afghan government hasn't done that. That's one piece of the context that needs policy focus. But most of the stories on it have been written as though we signed up to a level of cost that the Afghan government could never pay, ignores the context that we never expected the Afghan government to pay for it without revenue collection, and that there's plenty of reason to believe that they could collect the revenue because lots of people in Kabul at that point were buying power from small private generators that were more expensive. So there's a whole level of complexity there that's almost never explained. Now, you can fault us for various other pieces of the decision or not, but I just give that as an example of a context that has never made it into any of the news stories.
We have talked about State Department's role, and I think the military role, the DOD role in Afghanistan has been well covered. USAID seems to get short shrift as far as at least people paying attention to what it's doing in a lot of these situations. I'd like to talk about aid when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Ambassador Ronald Newman's my guest. He's author of the book, The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. He's the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy and former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The General Services Administration is closer than ever before to going paperless and accepting new offers and modifications to their contract schedules program. Houston Taylor is GSA's Assistant Commissioner for Acquisition Management in the Federal Acquisition Service. He says vendors under the technology schedule, known as Schedule 70, must submit all new offers and any modifications to their contracts electronically starting October 1st. GSA will push the other scheduled contracts paperless during 2012.
Desktops, tablets, smartphones, thin clients. If you're in federal IT, these are your challenges. Visit cdwg.com/configuration to learn how our experts can help you meet them all with configured, imaged, asset-tagged client computing solutions. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn about Apple's MacBook Pro line of notebooks. Built for on-the-go computing, they combine performance and portability.
Do you worry about the kids being home alone after school? You don't need to. Experience peace of mind with Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security. Already have a system? Switch to Ackerman's award-winning monitoring and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and it's free to switch. Know your home is protected before the kids come home. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. 1-888-999-1070. Ackerman Security.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
House Homeland Security Committee ranking member Benny Thompson.
Despite being the new kid on the block, according to the recent GAO report, things are moving along. One of the positive aspects of putting the department together and over $300 billion in resources in it is that we've not had a successful incident on the homeland since 9/11.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Ambassador Ronald Newman, the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, is my guest. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He's author of the book, The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. And I mentioned before the break, the piece of the puzzle, not just in Afghanistan, but in our response to just about anything that happens around the world, is USAID. A lot of people, even people in government, because aid doesn't get nearly as much attention as the broader State Department does, are not aware of what the agency does, what the stated mission of the agency is. What is aid supposed, what role are they supposed to play, and do they have the tools that they need to be able to play that based on what you saw as they came into Afghanistan?
Well, aid has really three missions, and the answer to the tools is by and large no. Their biggest, longest time mission is long-term development. And as the name implies, that takes a lot of years to see what happens. And they have had some huge successes over the years. A lot of what has gone on in Korea, a lot of what has gone on in some of the South Asian countries, Philippines has a lot to do with what aid has done in those countries over the years. That gets largely forgotten. They had quite a bit of success in parts of Central America. But that's long-term, and by the time anybody can analyze a success in a long-term project, everybody's lost interest in that one and gone on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have a mission of disaster relief in which they are extremely good. They can give lessons to pretty much anybody in moving disaster relief quickly and organizing well.
We saw that in Japan.
We've seen it in other places. We saw it in Pakistan, my watch. Then there's a third piece of aid, which is the kind of bridging between immediate crisis and development, which they call stabilization. They're pretty good at that. Now, do they have the tools? No. There's a whole batch of tools they're missing. A lot of the tools they're missing are flexibility. Aid's been in place for a long time. As we were remarking on the break, pretty much any mistake or problem that has occurred in the last 30 or 40 years has led somebody either in Congress or in aid to write a regulation to try to prevent it from happening again, which gives you an incredibly impacted bureaucracy. It's like a ship that's been in the water so long it's covered with barnacles and it can't go faster without scraping the hull. Aid has some problems in its own procedures, moving money. Some of them incurred by the Congress. And then its biggest problem, again, is its lack of staff to actually oversee things, to make quick reactions, to supervise the contracts it writes in many cases. One of the problems I had in Afghanistan when we were trying to get a road contract moved was the contracting office that had to produce the bid for a U.S. company to bid on the project was located in Bangkok. And, you know, but they were a regional office because aid doesn't have the people not to have to spin it off into a small regional office impacted with too many contracts. Now, mm-hmm. I think that office had some problems at that time. But it's also a function of not having the right kind of people in the right place at the right time.
Why do you think, the kind of job that we do at explaining not only to other parts of the world, but to our own citizens, the value that they get for the money that we invest in other countries?
If I absolutely knew a good, quick, clean answer, I'd probably, you know, be marketing it. But
yeah. You'd be the next aid director.
I think there are two huge problems, and they intersect. One of them is aid's own fault. I think aid has a lot of trouble telling its own story in simple English. They tend to talk too much about individual projects, and they drown people in details sometimes. But the other problem that we all have is that there are a lot of misconceptions that are so firmly established that it's very difficult to get past them. There are surveys every few years that ask Americans, how much money do you think we're spending on foreign aid? What do you think we ought to spend? And you get answers. People think we're spending 20-25% of the budget on those darn foreigners and probably ought to be spending not more than 10. Maybe the answer would be lower now with the budget. But the reality is we spend less than 1% of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a massive misconception about what the tools and the money are and how many people there are out doing this, getting down to reality is very difficult. And then sometimes people simply want the impossible. I want good governance and a functioning economy, and I need it by next year to meet the strategic plan. Well, you're talking about massive social transformation that hasn't happened that fast in any country in the world. And then if you can't get it, you think it's the agency that's at fault. And sometimes I think it's the starting expectations.
I'm reminded of the old saying, cheap, fast, and good, pick two.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And we continually resist that. We want all three. And then if you can't have all three, the failure is in the delivery mechanism.
Ambassador Ronald Newman's my guest, author of The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. We'll wrap up our conversation just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Ravens fans, 1500 AM, Federal News Radio is your D.C. home for Ravens football. Listen to every game as the Ravens dominate the AFC North and march toward the Super Bowl.
Fires over the middle. It's intercepted. Ray Lewis with the pick. Flacco throws. End zone. Touchdown, Ravens. The Ravens offense delivers.
Catch all the action as the Ravens take on the Tennessee Titans Sunday, September 18th. Pregame starts at 12:30 p.m. on 1050 AM.
What is the U.S. Department of Agriculture doing to transform rural America and enhance its prosperity? What is the USDA doing to cut costs and improve organizational performance? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with his very special guest, Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
For more than 80 years, Motorola has been committed to keeping Americans safe. Today, Motorola Solutions provides interoperable communication systems that are built to open standards so federal, state, and local agencies can work together in emergency situations and be their best in the moments that matter. That's why first responders and others dedicated to keeping citizens safe choose Motorola Solutions, because they know Motorola Solutions always puts public safety first, just like they do. To learn more, visit MotorolaSolutions.com/80.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
How will you meet cost reduction mandates while maintaining IT operations? Looking for shortcuts to comply with Executive Order 13514 and the OMB scorecard? 1E, a leader in IT efficiency software, is working with your colleagues in the federal government to reduce PC power consumption at the VA, optimize bandwidth for the State Department, and maintain an app store at the Bureau of Reclamation. Go to 1E.com to find out how they can help. That's the number 1, the letter E.com. 1E, empowering IT efficiency and cost reduction for today's federal agency.
Join 36,000 people from around the world, including senior leaders from the Army, DOD, and Congress, at the 2011 AUSA Annual Meeting and Exposition. This professional development forum is October 10th through the 12th at the Washington Convention Center and features exhibits on two levels and in five halls, all centered around this year's theme, America's Army, the Strength of the Nation. Admission is free but limited to qualified persons. For more information, please visit www.ausa.org.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Ambassador Ronald Newman is my guest, and we're just about out of time, sir, and I'm grateful for you being here for the hour. I appreciate
Delighted.
It. The conversation will be posted later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and you can learn more about Ambassador Newman's book, The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan, on the In-Depth page on our website, too. What's the biggest misconception that even the average person within the federal government has about Afghanistan, either the people or the governing structure that's in place there now, or the country as a whole, or whatever?
Could be a lot of answers to that. But I think two of the biggest misconceptions are, first of all, people say it's never been a country. Not only is that nonsense, it's been a country since about 1746, but I think, very significantly in 25 years of civil war and insurgency, nobody fought to break away. So this view that it's the, has these sharp ethnic divisions and therefore it's not hung together is fallacious. In fact, when the Soviets were leaving, they tried to get two of the major ethnic groups, Uzbeks and Tajiks, to set up rump states. The Soviets wanted some protection from the most radical forces on their border, and both rejected those offers. So I think that's one conception. I think the second misconception, if that's the right word for it, is that people don't understand how traumatized the nation of Afghanistan is after 25 years of war. They look, I think, in some cases for people to perhaps be more proactive about their own future than people tend to be after they have had their lives turned over so many times by forces that are so much larger. That we tend to think everybody's like us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Americans have grown up, particularly successful people, when the going gets rough, you work harder and you succeed. And why don't other people do that? Well, when other people have lived with a history that when the going gets rough, somebody invades, your country is overrun, your family's killed by bombs, rockets that fall out of the sky, it doesn't teach you that immediately jumping up and working harder is the right approach to survival.
We're back to context again. It's a totally different context.
Yeah, and there are plenty of hardworking people. There are people, especially in the younger generation, that are enormously inspiring in Afghanistan. There are people that have suffered enormous losses and still are there working for their country. But when you relate to the country, you need to understand this context.
The subtitle of your book is Winning and Losing in Afghanistan, and that actually, before I even opened the book, I took it as an optimistic sign that there is, in your view, a plan to win, a possibility of winning, because there are so many people that say it's, as you said, it's not really a country. It's always going to be chaotic, and it's not even a place that we should hope to succeed at some point in the future.
I think it is still possible to succeed. I think it's gotten harder because we didn't pay attention, because we underfunded it. I suppose a part of my tale in that book is efforts to do things earlier when we were seeing quite clearly that the war was getting worse, that we weren't putting enough resources into it. Part of the tale is the long struggle in late 2005 to get $600 million in additional economic assistance, supplemental, and out of that request for $600 million, we got about 43 in the end, of which less than 30 was actually project money.
Mm-hmm.
It was that kind of short-sightedness that's made life harder. I do think we still have the possibility of success, and I think we have perhaps the largest misconception is that we actually don't have a war with people who still wish us ill, that we can have a unilateral choice to quit a war, and somehow that means the war goes away, even if the other folk still think they want to fight.
Mm-hmm. I could go on and on with you, Ambassador, and I appreciate your time today, but we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I enjoyed the conversation, as always, Ransom.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Ronald Newman is my guest on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose, right around the corner.